The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
What do we mean by public safety, you know, and what are the things that we think public safety involves and the kind of skills and capabilities that are needed, and which ones do we think that police have and are good at, and which ones do police think, you know, yeah, we shouldn't be doing this stuff, we're terrible at it, and we don't want to be doing it, you know, that then you can have a much, much, much more constructive conversation where I think you actually find a tremendous amount of common ground between police and critics of policing, you know, and that very different conversation is one about, you know, let's think about what our priorities are as a community. Let's think about how close or far away we are from achieving the goals that we want. Let's think about the ways in which budget is a piece of that, and what do we need to invest in? Where do we need to build capacity and build capabilities? Where do we want to, over time, you know, shift responsibilities? You know, I think that conversation is a good one, and police will be an enthusiastic part of it.
I'm Alan Rosenstein, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, March 2nd, 2021. Many scholars have written about the police, but almost all have done so from the outside. Rosa Brooks, a law professor at Georgetown University, is one of the few exceptions. In 2016, Brooks, already a successful scholar of national security law and a former official in the Department of Defense, joined Washington, D.C.'s Volunteer Police Reserve Corps as a sworn police officer. For several years, she patrolled in some of D.C.'s most disadvantaged neighborhoods, an experience she's chronicled in her new book, Tangled Up in Blue, Policing the American City. I talked to Brooks about her time in law enforcement, the structural challenges facing police in the United States, and the prospects for reform. It's the Lawfare Podcast, March 2nd. Rosa Brooks on American policing. So, Rosa, before I get to questions, I want to just congratulate you on writing such an excellent book. And I just want to point out two features that I loved about it in particular. First, it's wonderfully nuanced, which is something that I don't think you get nearly enough of in discussions of something as complicated as policing in today's hyper-polarized discourse. And your commitment to not oversimplifying and to showing all of the different sides to all the issues and kind of all of the contradictions, I found incredibly, incredibly refreshing. And obviously that makes it difficult to draw any obvious or simple lessons. And we'll get to that later on in the conversation. But that is one thing that I thought was really admirable. And the other thing that I love that I wanted to mention was just how wonderfully written the book is. It's exciting read. It's frequently very, very funny. It's also in places quite sad and quite tragic. And you and I are both law professors. We spend most of our time reading and writing heavily footnoted, dense legal scholarship, which of course has its time and place.
This was the bliss of getting tenure. Once I got tenure, I'm sorry to say, I said no more.
That is good to look forward to. Well, I at least still read and write exclusively heavily footnoted legal scholarship. So this was a wonderful change. So the first question I wanted to ask is the first question I had before I even opened the book. This was when I had first heard about it, and I'd known who you are and from your previous work. And the question that I had was, what is it that made you decide to do this, right? As you put it early in the book, you know, you're in your 40s, you have a spouse and kids and a tenured job at a top law school. And instead of spending your midlife crisis going and learning how to windsurf in Costa Rica or something, you decide to become a reserve DC police officer. And I'm just super curious what the thought process for that was.
Yeah, my family thought I was absolutely nuts, as did those of my colleagues who were aware of it. No, well, first of all, thank you. Thank you, Alan, for your very kind words about the book and for having me on the podcast. That's actually the hardest question to answer. And I really struggled with answering that for myself as well. And as you know, part of the book is about my efforts to make sense of my own motivations, not a big part of the book, because that would get pretty boring. But part of it, you know, I think honestly, the single biggest drive was just sheer curiosity. My academic work has focused on the relationship between law and violence. And I've looked at that over the course of my career in a lot of different contexts. Also, a lot of my government work, my work at human rights NGOs, has focused on those issues. And in fact, has brought me into contact with policing issues in an international domain. So when I found out about this reserve officer program in DC, a lot of cities have reserves or auxiliaries who aren't sworn officers. They just essentially help with, you know, traffic, directing traffic at parades and so on. But when I found out that DC had a program where you could volunteer and if accepted, you go through the police academy and end up being issued, you know, a badge and a gun and full arrest powers, the same police powers that full-time career officers have, I sort of thought, whoa, you're kidding me. That's crazy. You can do that? And how fascinating, how weird, you know, and they're going to give a law professor a gun. That doesn't seem like a good idea. So that was, I think, the primary driver. And I would like to just say, oh, you know, I care about police reform and police transformation, and I thought this would be useful. And that's true. I do believe very deeply that if you want to change something, you have to understand it. And there is no better way to understand a culture and set of institutions than by, you know, being inside them. And we so rarely, the world of policing is so opaque and closed from the outside that it just seemed like this incredible opportunity to understand it from the inside. That I think, you know, at the end, it does sort of just come down, though, to curiosity.
I want to talk for a second about the reserve program itself, because as you point out, there is an oddity to have volunteer sworn police officers that, as you say, you give them a gun and a badge and you really treat them like just regular police officers, though presumably they are volunteers. And I'm curious, do you have a sense of why DC has this program and how successful it's been? I mean, you know, I was a government lawyer before I entered the legal academy, and I can only imagine, you know, trying to start a program like that now and just thinking of all the complexities and liabilities and downside risk of taking people and, again, training them, of course, but then giving them the full powers of the police. Yeah. Is this worked out well for DC? Do you think this is something that other cities should try?
Some other cities do have similar programs. It's not typical, but it's also, this is not the only program. In fact, I think LA is the largest city that has a similar program. But, you know, I think from the city's perspective, it does two things. One is that not dissimilar to military reserves, it provides a little bit of surge capacity. You know, so for instance, on January 6th, when so many MPD officers were pulled into events at the Capitol, reserve officers were asked to volunteer to backfill them in their patrol districts. And, you know, many reserve officers did exactly that. So part of it is just the kind of surge capacity. But I think the other thing that from the city's perspective it does, and this is also parallel to the military reserves, is it gives you some people who straddle, you know, the community and the police department and have a foot in both worlds. And it's a way to bring different perspectives into the department. It's a way to bring in potentially some skill sets that you don't have as much of within the department when you need it. So I think from their perspective, we'll see how they feel about it after this book. But I think for the most part, from their perspective, it's been a successful program. It's been going strong for, I don't know, I can't remember how long, but, you know, 70 years or so at this point. There are about 100 reserve officers. And most of them tend to be older on average and better educated on average than the typical career recruit. You know, you got a lot of people in the Reserve Corps with PhDs, or they work as lawyers or whatever. And I do think that sometimes they bring a different perspective to patrolling than the career officers do.
I also have to assume that it also creates a set of people, you know, whether they're law professors like you or doctors, lawyers, you know, people who are kind of maybe in more elite spheres than you often can draw from in terms of recruiting police officers who appreciate the complexities of policing. I mean, I view this book, and I don't necessarily want to say it's a sympathetic portrayal, because I don't want to sort of prejudge it or anything like that. It's a very nuanced portrayal, but it's certainly much more understanding of the challenges facing police than I think a lot of reflexive critiques of policing can be from people who have clear and legitimate critiques, but may not sort of appreciate how, in what ways it's such a difficult job. And so I wonder if what they also get is a group of people who, while they understand the flaws of the police, actually come away from with a much more sympathetic perspective of what it takes to do policing.
Yeah, definitely.
Now, one interesting feature of your biography is that your mother, who you talk about in the book, is Barbara Ehrenreich. And she herself, of course, is a famous author and activist. And in some ways, interestingly, kind of your experience as a police officer, in some ways, very interestingly, to me at least, mirrored in some ways your mother's experience embedding in certain groups over her career, though, of course, in other ways, it was very opposite. And you weave your relationship with her, and in particular, her reactions to your choice to join the police force through the book. And it's pretty clear that, especially at the beginning, she was not thrilled with this decision. and maybe that's an understatement. but that her views changed or evolved perhaps a little bit over the time period. So I'm curious, you know, now that you've written this book, now that you've had some distance from this experience, perhaps she has, and, you know, how has she viewed this experience of yours? And I guess also not just how has she viewed it, but how have others in your orbit, whether friends or colleagues who may not have been particularly well disposed to the idea of you becoming a police officer?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think my mother came round in the end, although it took a while. I mean, we had a lot of very tense conversations about it. You know, I felt very hurt that she was not trusting me enough to feel confident that good things would come of this. I mean, her view was just the police are the enemy. But I think in the end, between the book and between some of the programs that we started, it's led to the creation of the Innovative Policing Program at Georgetown, which I run along with several of my faculty colleagues. And you know, she came to some of the programs we did, and, you know, she did it. She did finally say to me at one point, I should have had more faith in you. You know, this is wonderful. And I was very glad that she had come around to that point of view. It took a while though.
So your book is kind of goes sequentially through your experience. Although the most of the book is about you actually being a police officer, in some ways I found the most fascinating part of the book for me was your description of training. And this is something I really appreciated, because I don't think one gets usually a lot of insight into the training that police officers get. And it does seem that a lot of the issues, the kind of pathologies, one might say, that you know, we then sort of see and in policing, and that police themselves have to deal with, a lot of that sort of begins during training. And so in particular, there's one kind of contradiction that comes out over and over again that I would love to get your thoughts on in your training, which is that on the one hand, your training constantly emphasized the dangers of being a police officer, that you could be injured or killed at any moment by anyone, seemingly with any weapon at any time for any reason. And therefore, you had to always maintain this incredible vigilance, lest you be injured on the job. And then on the other hand, the need to follow very rigid, sometimes seemingly arbitrary or illogical department procedures was constantly drilled into you. And the fact that if you made a mistake, you would be, you know, hung out to dry, as it were. I'm curious sort of how you and, let's say, the other recruits and then the police officers that you yourself then worked with, I mean, how do you deal with these conflicting messages, and what do you think that conflict ends up causing?
Yeah, you know, it's sort of fascinating. It's one of the paradoxes of policing is that on the one hand, police officers are entrusted by the state with tremendous power. You know, they're given the power to deprive people of their liberty and even their lives. And it's impossible to think about policing without acknowledging that. On the other hand, individual police officers within their own departments often feel extremely powerless. You know, police departments are very hierarchical. You know, they're paramilitary in structure. By and large, they do not tend to encourage the junior ranks to raise questions or challenge accepted procedures. There's, you know, a bit of an atmosphere of shut up and do what I tell you and follow the rules or you're out. And you don't rise in the department by being innovative. You rise by doing it by the book. But the problem is, as you know, the book, doing it by the book is almost impossible because, like all bureaucracies, certainly the Metropolitan Police Department generates all kinds of rules and regulations, some of them often in conflict with one another, some of them so confusing that you can't quite figure out what they are. And, you know, another irony is that that puts police officers structurally in a similar position to ordinary people. You know, I mean, one thing that people will often say, and it's absolutely true, is that there are so many traffic violations that are on the books, most of which you probably don't even know about, that any police officer worth their salt, if they want to find a valid, lawful reason to pull you over, can find it. You know, they trail you for a few blocks, you are going to do something wrong, guaranteed. You know, you're not going to come to a full and complete stop at a stop sign. You know, you're going to fail to signal when you change lanes, or maybe you have a parking tab obscuring your, you know, front windshield or whatever. And that makes people very vulnerable. And that, you know, bias can obviously creep in when you have a kind of open-ended power to stop people. Ironically, within their own organizations, police feel like they're in the same position, that there are so many rules and regulations that at any given time, every officer is probably violating some of them, right? Often unknowingly or accidentally, which in turn means that there's a perception on the part of police officers that if somebody above you, if your sergeant or your lieutenant doesn't like you, they will always be able to find a reason to discipline you because you will inevitably be doing something wrong. And that makes them feel very vulnerable and very powerless.
And what's the role of policing unions in all of this? And you know, I ask because I think, yeah, well, I ask because I think traditionally the conception of policing unions is that they're there to back up police officers to enforce the kind of sometimes called the blue wall of silence, and they sort of stand in the way of reform. I mean, I'm in the Twin Cities area in Minnesota, and you know, in the wake of the George Floyd killings, the Minneapolis police union and the head of that police union did not, how shall we say, did not inspire confidence in terms of amenability to reform. I mean, was that your experience, or do police officers also find themselves kind of abandoned in their own way by their own police union?
No, I mean, I do think that the police union tries to back people up, not only when they do things that really are wrong, you know, that aren't a sort of trivial violation of some obscure rule that has no bearing on actual quality of their policing, but also, you know, I think that they feel that the police union does back them up, but it doesn't always help. More broadly, though, I think police unions in general have obviously not been progressive forces. They, which is sad, you know. I mean, in general, I'm very strongly pro-union, and unions can and should be a force for innovation within organizations and change, but police unions have not been. Interesting, we have a program that we run, a fellowship program for young officers, and this issue just came up in one of our recent conversations with our fellows, and they were talking about the role of police unions, and one of them said to the others, you know what, guys, this is our union, you know, it's up to us to change it. You know, everybody's saying we don't feel well represented by the union. We don't feel that the union, there were concerns about the FOP endorsing Trump and things like that. But he said, you know, we need to get involved in the union so that we run it. And I thought, hear.
One of the most striking statistics that you point out, and this really was very surprising to me, is that the average DC cop that's kind of on the beat makes, I think it was about one arrest a month, if I'm getting that statistic right. And you use this to emphasize just how little of policing is directly tied to stopping crime. And you know, obviously, if you're making one arrest a month, there's a lot of time that you're not doing, you know, that you're using to do other things. And that seems to, in your telling at least, an awful lot of time spent dealing with mental health crises, dealing with family disturbances, things that one could argue would have been dealt better, or could be dealt better, or at least equally well by a sort of social worker than, let's say, a police officer with a badge and a gun and handcuffs and all of that. You know, do you agree with that? And if so, I'm particularly curious then what you think about some of the calls that have recently been made by whether it's kind of police abolition or police defunding to radically shrink the size of the police, right? Again, in Minneapolis, right near where I am, there's this discussion of, well, let's get rid of the police and let's replace it with a Department of Public Safety. And of course, you know, some of those people would have guns and would be kind of traditional police officers, but there'd be much more of the sort of social support work. Do you think that's a reasonable path forward?
You know, in the long run, yes, I do. Absolutely. But to sort of start with that issue, how often police officers arrest people, you know, well, and I should also note, by the way, that arrests don't necessarily stop crime. They're responding after a crime has occurred. And there is a big debate within policing about the degree to which police ever prevent crimes as opposed to simply respond to them. But, you know, leaving that aside as a whole other conversation, I think the image of policing that people have is very informed by the media and by Hollywood, you know, and it's all car chases and, you know, homicide investigations and bad cops beating people up or shooting people. And, you know, whether it's good or bad, it's high drama. And most policing is incredibly mundane. You know, it's not high drama at all. It's responding to somebody calling to say that their neighbor's party is too noisy, or that their teenager is sassing them. They don't usually say that to the 911. They say, you know, somebody reports a family disturbance because they hear shouting in another apartment or something like that. Or somebody calls in, you know, to say that there's an assault in progress, a domestic violence assault, or not to mention all the, there's a homeless guy wandering around and, you know, he's in the doorway of the Starbucks and people don't like that. You know, what are you going to do about it? There's a mentally ill person who's roaming around the middle of the street in traffic and people are worried he's going to get hit by a car. You know, there's somebody who's overdosed. You know, police are often the first on the scene. You know, there is violent crime and there are shootings and stabbings and rapes and armed robberies and all sorts of terrible stuff. But most of policing consists of responding to these much more mundane complaints. And police do help people. You know, the fact that they take sick people to the hospital. They do CPR on people whose hearts have stopped. They comfort victims of robberies. You know, that there is a lot of policing that is helping. That is not to say that there aren't real abuses. There are. But you know, just as the helping behavior doesn't mean the abuses aren't real, the fact that the abuses are real doesn't mean that the helping isn't real too. So I think it's complicated because on the one hand, yeah, some of those things absolutely, you know, don't need an armed officer to handle them. And many of those things, in fact, I think if you ask most cops, they're going to say, I shouldn't be doing this. I don't think I'm the right person to do this. You know, that we essentially ask cops at the moment, we want them to be, you know, warriors and protectors and medics and mediators and social workers and mentors all at once, often in the space of a single shift. And doing any one of those jobs well is really hard. Doing all of them is pretty much impossible. And you won't get a lot of cops who will disagree with that. You know, that often they're the first people to say, we shouldn't be doing this. Or, you know, a related complaint that police often have is, okay, I get that you may need an armed officer to deal with a mentally ill person who's wandering around waving a knife or threatening people in some way, but I can bring this guy to the emergency psychiatric clinic where they're going to dope him up for the night and he's going to be back on the street tomorrow. And I can bring him again and he'll be back on the street the next day. And my frustration is not that I have to deal with it in the first instance, but that there's no mental health programs that will keep it from being a revolving door. And I wish there were better services. I wish there were better psychiatric services. I wish there were more shelter opportunities for homeless people and so on. So, and that, you know, getting back to that whole defund the police issue, You know, I think that the rhetoric is divisive, and at the moment seems clear from public opinion polls that it's not just cops who don't like the rhetoric. It's a lot of Americans find it off-putting. It doesn't have a tremendous amount of support, including in poor communities and communities of color, you know, where people will often say, we don't want no policing, we just want better policing, want different policing. But if you shift the conversation from, okay, we need to slash budgets or we need to eliminate police, if you shift that conversation to what do we mean by public safety, you know, and what are the things that we think public safety involves and the kind of skills and capabilities that are needed, and which ones do we think that police have and are good at, and which ones do police think, you know, yeah, we shouldn't be doing this stuff, we're terrible at it and we don't want to be doing it, you know, that then you can have a much, much, much more constructive conversation where I think you actually find a tremendous amount of common ground between police and critics of policing, you know, and that very different conversation is one about, you know, let's think about what our priorities are as a community. Let's think about how close or far away we are from achieving the goals that we want. Let's think about the ways in which budget is a piece of that, and what do we need to invest in? Where do we need to build capacity and build capabilities? Where do we want to, over time, you know, shift responsibilities? You know, I think that conversation is a good one, and police will be an enthusiastic part of it. You know, and one version of that is to say, well, maybe we reconceptualize this as a public safety office and think about, you know, a kind of a continuum of different types of skills and interventions. You know, there are a lot of ways to go at it. And I think that conversation is possible, but I think the rhetoric can be kind of challenging.
So let me then turn to another area in which I think the rhetoric can sometimes trip us up. And that is how we discuss the issue of race and policing. And one of the things that I really appreciate about your book, and I think the next time I teach criminal procedure, I will just sort of assign this chapter from your book.
No. Ellen, you have to assign the entire book. You have to tell them all they've got to buy it.
Yes, that's right. Yes, that's right. That's right. Pre-orders are also very important, everyone. But I think one of the best parts of your book is when you discuss the issue of racial disparities in policing. You do just a wonderful job unpacking all the different things we mean by, let's take the word, you know, racist in the sense of racist policing, right? That on, you know, in some sense, there are obviously some cops who are themselves personally racist in the sense of animus. There are a bunch of cops who themselves may not be personally racist in the sense of animus, but they are in a system that is, for a variety of reasons, some having to do with policing, something to do with criminal law, some having to do with background, economic, and social conditions, is stacked against minority groups. So this may be where a term like structural racism comes in handy. And you do a really good job of explaining how all those things link. But one thing you do point out is that the actual police officers themselves, including those from the very minority groups that often have the biggest legitimate complaints about police, they were quite resistant in many ways to thinking about the problems of policing in terms of race, right? To them, they were just doing their job. They were doing it in a colorblind way. If, you know, the majority of their suspects were, let's say, Black, that was just a function of, you know, where they were policing in DC and had sort of nothing to do with, you know, their own views or anything like that. And so I guess my question is, how useful is it to talk about policing reform in the context of the racial issues? Because on the one hand, they're obviously important and they play a significant role and you don't want to ignore them. On the other hand, do they get in the way of some potential reforms that would help everyone? And sort of how do you think through that problem?
I don't think you can talk about how we should change policing without talking about race. But I do think that there are different ways to talk about it, and some that are more likely to get you to good conversations than others. My experience is that nobody's mind was ever changed by telling them that they're, you know, stupid and evil. And it's very hard, I think, for police officers who often haven't really thought about it very much to hear, you know, policing is racist without feeling like somebody saying, you're a racist, you're a bad person. And they get super defensive, you know, and I am not a racist and I'm Black myself, you know, drop dead. It shuts down the dialogue. But one of the things I do think, but you have to talk about it. I think it's a question of how you talk about it. And, And one of the things that we tried to do with the one of the programs that we started that kind of came out of this experience from when we started something called the Innovative Policing Program at Georgetown Law. And our initial sort of core project was something called the Police for Tomorrow Program. And it's a program through which young officers, they apply, it's a fellowship, they have to apply, it's a competitive process. If they're selected, the fellows participate in pretty intensive workshops over the course of about 18 months. Most are held at Georgetown, although some are held in other places. And we talk about all the hard issues, you know, race and policing, you know, what is the role of police, poverty and policing, mental illness, you name it. And I think that there are good ways to have those conversations as well as bad ways. And, you know, we have our fellows. One of the things that we do, for instance, is we unfortunately can't do this right now because of COVID with the current cohort, but we, with our last cohort, for instance, we took them to the Smithsonian's Anacostia Museum, which had a wonderful exhibit on DC's changing demographics and really highlights the ways in which current residential patterns and demographics are so powerfully driven by discrimination, overt discrimination in the past, you know, restrictive covenants and, you know, zoning rules that restricted certain kinds of businesses and gentrification that drove poor people, particularly African Americans, out of certain parts of the city, tax incentives and so on that have meant that larger grocery store chains and so on don't tend to open stores in poorer parts of the city. So you have to travel further if you want to get fresh vegetables and something other than junk food. The transportation decisions that mean that in some parts of the city, including the poorest parts of the city, if you want to get to the place where the better paying jobs are, you're going to be taking, you know, two metros and three buses. And that, I think, was really profoundly affecting for the young officers in our program, you know, many of whom are not from DC, you know, and it led them to kind of think in a different way. Well, why is this neighborhood the way this neighborhood is? To be able to kind of see, oh, I get what you're saying. You're not saying I'm a racist. You know, you're not saying I'm a bad person. You're saying that the toxic legacy of discrimination still profoundly affects the choices people have, the places they live, their economic opportunity, et cetera, et cetera. You know, that things like that can really change people's views. You know, and we also, you know, the buzzword for the last 5 years has been implicit bias. And we also do some stuff on that. And that can help too, you know, that sort of getting people to see it's not my fault, but it is my responsibility. You know, so taking away from something that says that seems very blaming, you know, very judgmental, you know, you're a bad person to, oh, you know, none of us, you know, we don't control our implicit biases. They're implicit, but we can control what we do. And if we're aware that implicit bias may impact, for instance, who we perceive as a threat, and that in turn may profoundly affect, you know, who do we stop? Who do we stop and frisk, for instance? You know, that if you're aware of that, then you have the opportunity to make conscious decisions, change that behavior. So I think it is both important and possible to have conversations with cops about race and policing in a way that leads them to think differently about their work and their role.
I want to take a moment to situate this book in the context of other writing you've done. And the reason is, now, I first came to know about your work through this wonderful book that you wrote, I think it came out in 2016, How Everything Became War and the Military Became Everything. And it's this really interesting exploration of how over the last several decades, the United States has increasingly seen every foreign policy issue through the lens of military conflict rather than diplomacy or foreign aid or international development. And that as a consequence, we have asked the military to do the sorts of things that, again, in previous generations, you might have asked your diplomat or your foreign aid worker to do, and that this has caused all sorts of problems. And it really struck me as I read this book, and I know you point this out sort of near the end of the book, you make this comparison explicit. It seems like we're doing the exact same thing with policing. I mean, you could have called this book How Everything Became a Crime and Policing Became Everything. Yeah. And this can't be a coincidence, right? What is it about American society or American policymaking or American culture that makes us see every problem through the lens of the application of state violence?
Yeah, I can't answer that question. It is the question. But yes, absolutely. There are many times as I was working on Tangled Up in Blue that I thought, you know, I could have equally titled it how everything became crime and policing became everything, but that would be goofy. So I didn't, it would be weird if I had two books with identical title structures. So I didn't, but no, that is a big part of the story. And part of what led me to an interest in policing in the first place was thinking about the ways in which the increasing blurriness between the domestic and foreign spheres, between military and civilian, the ways in which in many overseas settings, including overseas wars, in many places, American warfighting better resembles policing, some of the certainly counterinsurgency approaches, and the ways in which increasingly domestically, some American policing more resembles warfighting. And there are a lot of different dimensions to that. You know, one of those dimensions is, I think the one that gets the most media attention is these various federal programs that provide state and local police departments with surplus military goods. And some of that is innocuous, right? It's police departments getting, you know, used filing cabinets that the Army doesn't want anymore. But some of it is not so innocuous. It's, you know, small town police departments that are getting tanks and Humvees, and how that sort of changes both their perceptions of themselves and community perceptions of policing, you know, is one dimension of that militarization. The other and the more complicated piece of this, and this is, again, similar to the story of the military's ever expanding role, is that, you know, in the international sphere, we sort of talk about the global threat environment is changing, and the military's expansion in some ways has been a rational response to an evolving threat environment in which threats are more decentralized and more diffuse. In the domestic context, some of the militarization of policing is also a response to the, you know, evolving threat environment, which is to say both the ubiquity of weapons in civilian hands in the United States, the increasing prevalence of very sophisticated organized crime organizations, you know, like drug cartels that essentially operate in a military manner with military equipment and military tactics, you know, the mass shooting situations. Some of that police response has been driven by the perceived need to respond to threats that look more like war. And I think that this dilemma was really illustrated on January 6th, the failed insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, where police who certainly initially were kitted out for ordinary policing, you know, that the Capitol police at the outer perimeters, they weren't wearing helmets or anything. They were just dressed in sort of ordinary daily uniform and faced with a mob that turned out to be armed and organized. They fell back. You know, they couldn't handle it. And that led to sort of a call for why didn't we have police? You know, why didn't we have more militarized police? So you know, I do think it's a really tricky issue.
And it also seems to me that and I hadn't thought until just now about this point, that policing is also getting more militarized in part because our expectations of the sorts of threats that have to be dealt with are increasing. I mean, if that's the case, then it seems even more untenable to have police also be working as social workers, as medical first responders, as mediators. I mean, you can't, it seems impossible to train someone both to be a, you know, the police equivalent of a Navy SEAL, and also then expect that they're going to be able to sort of calmly diffuse a spat between a teenage girl and her mother, which is something that you point out is a remarkably high percentage of the domestic disturbance calls that police in DC have to deal with.
Yeah, you know, and I don't know a ton about the British model, but what little I know suggests, for instance, that they handle it quite differently, that the bobbies, you know, the average street constables are unarmed, and they're the ones who sort of respond to the basic calls for service, which include the, you know, domestic squabbles and so on. That they also have armed units who can be called in as backup if there's a reason to believe, you know, and this can be the case in domestic calls, that there is a high potential for real violence. And then you have sort of more specialized units that do counterterrorism and that do, you know, hypothetically active shooters, although the Brits, somehow America seems to grow active shooter incidents more than any other country. But that you do kind of, you know, that your counterterrorism police and your equivalent of your SWAT teams are, you know, they're not responding to the disorderly conduct calls, that there is more of a division of labor within policing where you have the unarmed cops taking on the bulk of those sort of everyday tasks. I think the thing that makes this complicated, genuinely complicated, though, you know, is America is different because there are so many guns. Just so many guns in our society. And that's not true in any other country. I mean, there are more per capita guns in America than there are in places like Libya and Syria, which is nuts. And so it is hard to say, oh, well, could we transition to unarmed people, whether we call them public safety officers or police, or whether we call them, you know, our sort of mental health squad or whatever. You know, some cities that have tried to replace police with unarmed social workers have found it hard to persuade those people to go, because, you know, although one of the things I talk about a lot in the book is the detrimental impact of police paranoia, the police conviction that there's constant threat everywhere, it's not wrong to believe that a lot of those situations can present some risk, at least. And, you know, domestic violence calls are a classic example. They are one of the most likely contexts in which lethal violence directed at police can occur, you know, because you're going into a really volatile situation. There may be an armed and enraged person, you know, who is super enraged because, you know, it's not just a, you know, cold-blooded killing in the course of a robbery. It's you know, all mixed up with intimate relationships. And asking unarmed people to be the ones to, you know, walk in the middle of that, that's a pretty big ask. And it's not completely clear that that's feasible at this moment, at least.
I want to close out the conversation by kind of looking forward in terms of reform and ways that we can sort of improve policing for everyone involved. And one of, again, the really nice features of the book is that it embraces the complexity of this policy problem, right? And it doesn't look for any easy solutions. But, you know, you've been a police officer for several years. You obviously think and write about this. And right now, there seems to be an opening for the sorts of wide-ranging police reform that just was not on the table until several years ago. And so I am curious, you know, if you were the governor of a state, or if you were advising, you know, President Biden or DC Mayor Bowser, or, you know, my governor, Tim Walz in Minnesota, right? If there was one thing, one concrete change that you could make that you think obviously wouldn't solve the whole problem, but would really be just a very effective way of improving it, what would that be?
I'm going to resist that question. This is not something where it's like, you know, one neat trick to get rid of your belly fat. There is not one neat trick. There just isn't. This is a problem that is going to take chipping away at it from a lot of different angles, preferably simultaneously. And anybody who sort of imagines that, well, let's just do this and that will somehow make a substantial difference, I think is mistaken. But if I were to rattle off a quick list of what police can do and what they can't and what others need to do, I would say, you know, police departments need to demilitarize police training and really radically overhaul police academies so that there is much, much more emphasis on de-escalation skills, verbal skills, cooling things down skills, getting the tactical skills to get time, space, and distance in volatile situations so that people aren't panicking and pulling out their weapons. That would be one piece. Who and how we recruit would be another piece. And that's something police departments can change. We didn't even talk about the gender dynamics there. The percentage of women in law enforcement nationwide is about 12 to 13%, which is stunningly low, lower than in the military. So there'd be a bunch of things that cops can do, you know, police departments can do on their own. But there's a whole lot that I think this is a really important point, you know, police don't operate in a vacuum. You know, they're enforcing laws they didn't create in a social context. They can't do a heck of a lot to change. And, you know, if we don't like the fact that police are arresting people for trivial offenses, we need to look in the mirror because we're the people who elected the people who criminalized those trivial offenses. You know, and I would say every state and city needs to a serious scrub of their criminal codes to look at all the offenses where we've turned things that used to be misdemeanors into felonies. We've turned things that used to be civil infractions into misdemeanors. That can change, but the police can't change that. You know, we've decided that we want armed people to enforce civil traffic regulations. We don't have to do that. That's a choice. We can change that. You know, we don't have armed, you know, armed police don't come to your door if you miss an IRS tax filing deadline, right? Why do armed police stop your vehicle if you turn right on red when there's a no right on red sign? You know, that we can really rethink those choices. But a lot of those things cannot be done by police themselves. They have to be done by legislators, by prosecutors, by judges.
I think that's a good place to wrap up. Rosa, thank you so much for writing the book, and thank you for talking with me about it.
Alan, thank you so much for having me on.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. If you've liked what you've heard, please take a moment to rate the podcast or let someone know so they can enjoy it as well. This podcast is produced by Jen Patya Howell. Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo is our audio engineer, and Sophia Yan performed our music. As always, thanks for listening.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.